So let me start with a brief recap of last time by way of overview. So the topic is structuralism. And a structuralist thesis says, in some sense, about some specified domain, the pattern is primary and the nodes in the pattern are secondary. Pattern is some sort of network of properties and relationships of the nodes, which are the entities in the pattern, and the structuralist thought has always got this form. There's something important about the pattern. Now, the question is how to make structuralist theses precise. And I've said that we should do this in different, we do this in different ways depending on our metaphysical tools of choice. The metaphysical tools one uses are the basic concepts you use to articulate metaphysical problems. So how you're going to make this vague idea precise depends on what concepts you choose to make it precise, your metaphysical tools. Using modal concepts, it's pretty straightforward. Structuralist theses can then be understood just as the claim that patterns and nodes can't vary independently in various senses. But what I'm after in these talks is postmodal articulations of structuralism. The postmodal slogan is something like this. I don't want just an account of what all possible worlds are like. I want an account of the structure of this world that makes it the case that all worlds are a certain way. I don't want just a claim that it's impossible for nodes and patterns to vary. I want to know what it is about the structure of this world that makes independent variation impossible. And I talked about some different conceptual tools one might use to articulate in postmodal terms structuralist theses. I mentioned fundamentality, essence, and ground. So for this week, I want to look in depth at one particular kind of structuralist position, or one kind of position you can think of as a form of structuralism. And the relevant kinds of patterns here are patterns of lawful or gnomic relationships between properties, between scientific properties. So we're talking about, so the nodes in these patterns are scientific properties, properties like mass and charge in classical physics, and the relationships, the grid of relationships, or the pattern, are the gnomic relationships, the relationships that these properties bear to each other because of the laws of nature that govern them. So in classical physics, the laws connect properties like mass and charge, properties having to do with the electromagnetic field, and properties of location that connect all these properties with each other via the laws of classical physics. And so a structuralist thought is, well, these relationships of lawful dependence are primary and the actual particular properties in the relationships are secondary. So gnomic essentialism, at least in some ways of thinking of what it amounts to, counts as a structuralist position in this sense. So the basic thought of gnomic essentialism is that properties and laws are not independent. You can't understand what the properties are independently of the laws. You got to bring the laws in there somehow. Actually, most of the literature is not focused so much on gnomic essentialism. So gnomic essentialism has to do with the relationship between properties and laws. And it has, not all, but most of it is more talked about the relationship between properties and dispositions. Another kind of connection between properties is properties disposed to bring about that property, or causal powers, or causation. The reason I'm talking about the connection between properties and laws rather than causation or causal powers or dispositions is I want to get at an issue about the underlying fundamental structure of reality, and in my view, laws are more likely to be fundamental than causation or disposition or causal powers. But that's an opinion, and there are people who will disagree with that. In any case, that's why I focus on laws rather than causal powers and the like, which are more commonly focused on, at least in some of the literature. So why be a dispositional or gnomic essentialist? Well, the argument often has to do with the possibility of swapping roles in the laws of nature. So if you think that, so the opposing view to gnomic essentialism is often called quiditism, which says that properties and the laws are independent in a certain way. And so the quiditist wants to say you can understand what a property is without bringing its laws into it at all, continuing to keep this at a vague level. If that's so, then it should be possible for a given property, like the property of mass or the property of having a certain mass, to have obeyed different laws. Or even, it should have been possible for the properties of mass and charge to have swapped their role in the laws of nature, so that mass obeys laws, obeyed laws that are like what laws that charge actually obeys, and vice versa. And then there follows some sort of complaint about the idea that that could happen, that mass and charge could swap their roles. One sort of argument would be epistemic, and this is familiar, given some of the things you said in the first day. The argument might be, how could we know anything about mass and charge if mass and charge could have swapped their roles, because all we know about a property is via what it does and what other properties do to it. We only know the role. We don't know the nature of charge itself. Another kind of argument is more metaphysical, less epistemic. It just says this swap is a distinction without a difference, and so we need a metaphysics that blocks it. There just isn't any real difference between a world in which charge and mass play the gnomic roles they actually play, in a world in which they swap the place. Now, I don't like either of these arguments, and this is just very superficially. Seems to me the threat to knowledge that's posed by swapping roles isn't any... I mean, you shouldn't similarly worry that you don't know that it's really me rather than Barack Obama talking, even if you think that Barack Obama and I could have swapped roles, or even if you think, as you likely do, that it's possible that it looks just like this, but you're dreaming. The epistemic argument here doesn't to me, feel pressing. And the metaphysical argument that the swapping worlds are a distinction without a difference feels like it relies on an overly observational conception of a distinction without a difference. But those are just, I'm just pointing at familiar directions that quidditists usually take in responding to these arguments. I don't want to focus on the arguments, though. I want to just give you those arguments just so that this isn't too much in a vacuum. These are the kinds of considerations that gnomic essentialists usually put forward. I want to direct our attention to the question of what gnomic essentialism is. What exactly does it mean to say that properties are bound up with the laws that govern them, or that they're not independent from the laws that govern them? What is this contrast in precise terms? That calls for articulating the thesis given some metaphysical tools. In modal terms, if you use modal tools, it's very straightforward. And maybe at the end you'll conclude that the discussion in this particular domain anyway should have been left in the modal arena at the start. But the modal articulation is straightforward. There are various theses one can state to the effect that properties and laws cannot vary independently. There isn't just one thesis of that sort. There are multiple. So one thing you could just say is, you could just say, well, swapping of roles is impossible. You could say that a given property that has a given gnomic role, it obeys some laws, couldn't have obeyed different ones. You could say that it would be impossible for a different property to obey the same laws. That is, you could say that if a property actually obeys those laws, then it's necessarily true that any property obeying laws of that sort is that very property. So those are some modal theses one can state. But if you've got that post-modal hankering for a non-modal, post-modal articulation of reality structure that would give rise maybe to such modal theses, you're going to want more. And so my question is, what more is there to have? Is there to be had? So let me first start talking about attempts to formulate this gnomic essentialist vision of properties being intertwined with laws using the concept of ground. So the idea of ground, remember, is you take seriously this impulse we often have in philosophy to talk like this. This holds in virtue of or because of that. You give the metaphysical reason for something being the case. You give a more fundamental account that gives rise to the phenomenon in question, if you want to give a metaphysical account of some phenomenon. So we talk about, and Kit Fine uses the term ground for this notion of metaphysical dependence or metaphysical in virtue of or metaphysical explanation. And so the first thing I want to look at is whether gnomic essentialism should be understood as a claim that has this form. A statement that
the particular instantiations of scientific properties like charge and mass are grounded in, hold in virtue of something about the laws. So we say something of the form, something about the laws grounds or makes it the case that a particular object, say A, has a certain property, P. Something about the laws makes it the case that a particular object has mass. See, the metaphysical account of what it is for a particular thing to have a particular scientific property always drags in the laws somehow. That's the sense in which properties cannot be understood independently of laws. So what of this form might nomic essentialism take? Here's an obstacle. Whatever goes in here has to connect to A, the object in question that is that has the property. But laws don't connect to particular objects by name. Laws are general. They connect to objects, they say something about objects via their properties. And the relevant property is surely going to be P. And so there's a concern that what we write in here is going to assume stuff about P. And so there's going to be a kind of circularity in the metaphysical account of what it is for an A to have P. P is going to be inappropriately brought in there somehow into the ground of A's having P. So let me talk about a particular instance of this strategy that clearly does have this problem. The problem of the circularity of ground. The problem here is an instance of the second type of obstacle for ground theoretic articulations of structuralism that I talked about last week. It's a conflict between a structuralist idea and the logic of the postmodal concept in question, in this case, ground. So here's the idea. The reason, or the metaphysical explanation of A's having P, is that A has some property or other that plays an appropriate role. A has mass because A has a property that plays the mass role. A has P because there exists some property P such that P plays a certain role in the laws of nature and A has that property. So the A having that property is what connects the proposed ground to A, but the property that A is said to have plays the right kind of role in the laws. So that gives us a view according to which you always got to drag the laws in if you want an account of a property's being had. So this should strike you as intuitively off. I mean, how could the right explanation of an object's having mass be that it has some property with the right kind of role? And that warning bell that's going off in your head, I'm assuming, is some sort of response to the argument that, I mean, it's the obvious sort of argument, an argument that appeals to certain principles about the logic of ground. And I'm not going to write all the principles up, but the principles are on your handout. They are the principle that existentials are grounded in their instances, the principle that conjuncts are grounded in their conjuncts, and the principle that the grounding relation is transitive and irreflexive. So existentials are grounded in their instances. The intuitive idea there is that the fact that someone is speaking and standing here holds in virtue of the fact that I am speaking and standing. Maybe someone else is also speaking and standing, and that fact also would ground the fact that I'm speaking and standing. So if that's true, given that existentials are grounded in their instances, this fact here is in turn grounded by any of its instances. And one of its instances is, of course, the fact that the property P, the particular property P, like having mass or having some particular mass, plays that role in the laws of nature, and the object in question has that property. Something plays that role and has that and is had by A because P plays that role and has A. That grounds that if existentials are grounded in their instances. And if conjunctions are grounded in their conjuncts, then this is grounded in turn by its right conjunct, A has P. Now, conjunctions aren't, in Fine's terminology, fully grounded by a single one of their conjuncts. You've got to put both conjuncts together to get a full ground. What I'm talking about in these principles is, let's then stipulate, is partial ground. Partial ground of something is just one of the full grounds of something. So conjunctions are partially grounded in their conjuncts. I'm sitting and standing in part because I'm standing and speaking in part because I'm standing. And in part because I'm speaking. So we've got this grounding this, grounding that. If ground is transitive, then A's having P grounds itself. Okay, right? Grounding is irreflexive. The whole idea of ground is to defend a hierarchical view of reality where we've got some fundamental facts that ground other things. They don't produce themselves. And so holding fixed these principles from the logic of ground, in particular the principle that existentials are grounded in their instances, which seems to me the key premise here, this view just can't be right. Okay, now I'm going to talk later on about the principle that existentials can't be grounded in their instances, and I'll say, think a bit about how one might go further than just assuming that. I'll tell you in advance, nothing I'm going to say is going to be decisive. But postpone that kind of thought. One thing that I suspect some gnomic essentialists might want to do, at least if they were open at all to the idea of articulating their view in terms of ground, is to back away from the idea that it's facts about properties, instantiations that are grounded in something about the laws, and say it's some other kinds of facts. And I'll talk about a few proposals of that sort in a moment. But before we leave this, it does seem to me this should have been the idea if we wanted to say that anything at all about properties is grounded in the laws. Because the idea we were starting with was the idea that you can't understand what properties are without bringing in the laws. And understanding what a property is should be giving an account of what makes it instantiated. That's the kind of a creature a property is. It's the kind of thing where to explain what it is, you say what it takes to instantiate. So it seems to me that really should have been the idea. But in any case, let's move on to some other ideas about what gnomic essentialism might amount to that are still claims about the laws, but now they're claims that other kinds of facts are grounded rather than property instantiations. So one idea might be, well, it's the existence of a property, not its instantiation, that's grounded in something about the laws. There's a question about exactly what kind of fact that is, but let's not worry about that right now. So just the fact that the property exists. Maybe something about the laws makes it the case that the property of having a certain mass exists. And the thing is, though, what is it going to be about the laws? I mean, the laws are facts about properties. So it's hard to see what facts about the laws there might be that don't already presuppose that the property exists. I mean, if the relevant fact about the laws is that P itself plays a certain role in the laws of nature, this is just schematic for some description of the kinds of laws is involved in. This is a singular fact about P. And if you like the idea at all that sometimes a thing's existence can be grounded in something, the ground surely has to be something that doesn't mention the thing. Because otherwise the ground just presupposes that the thing exists. Similarly, the ground ought not to be something which is in turn grounded in something that presupposes the thing. So you shouldn't say that P's existence is grounded in the fact that there is something that plays the relevant role. Because that is grounded in its instances, given the existentials principle, and thus is grounded in a claim that is presupposed by this fact here. I suppose someone might say that's okay if it's also grounded in something else that doesn't mention this, but in typical cases there isn't going to be any other property that plays the same gnomic role. Some gnomic essentialists would deny that you can have two properties playing the same gnomic role. So I don't think that idea is on the right track at all. Gnomic essentialists sometimes speak of the identities of properties in this kind of context. They say things like it's the identity of a property that's tied up with the laws. So we should think for a bit about claims of the form, something about the laws grounds something about properties' identities. What's that? So, I mean, a flat-footed idea is
the fact that a certain property is identical with itself is grounded in something about the laws. Maybe the singular claim that P itself obeys a certain set of laws, or maybe the claim that there's some law of that sort. Either way, I mean, I don't think this kind of claim is true, or I don't think I would think it was true if I loved ground more than I in fact do. I mean, I doubt that facts of self-identity have grounds at all. And if they do, surely, since everything is self-identical and intuitively for the same reason, you would think that the kind of fact that grounds my self-identity would be similar to the fact that grounds P's self-identity or anything else's identity with itself. I don't know, maybe the fact that I exist grounds the fact that I'm identical with myself. It doesn't seem right that it would be something specific to properties in one case and different in other cases. But in any case, this is just intuitively off. A claim about what makes it be the case that this logical truth holds, that mass is mass, feels distant from the kinds of concerns that gnomic essentialists have. So to see this, consider the kind of modal upshot of this sort of grounding claim. So as I said last time, the idea of ground is that you don't define ground in modal terms, because we want ground to articulate further philosophical questions in cases where all the modal questions are already settled. Nevertheless, ground isn't defined in terms of modality, but it's usually assumed to imply stuff about modality. So it's normally assumed that ground implies necessitation. If A grounds B, then it's necessary that if A, then B. So the modal upshot of this is that it's necessary that if, say, mass has the gnomic role it actually has, then it's self-identical. And this is a very weak claim. I mean, we already knew that P is self-identical in every possible world, or anyway, every world in which it exists. And so to know that it's self-identical in every world where it plays this gnomic role isn't an addition. This doesn't block role swapping. So this is on the wrong track. On the handout, there's a proposal that I'm not going to discuss here beyond just mentioning it. There is the possibility of formulating a claim about identity in terms of a generic notion of ground that some people have been recently talking about. Daniel Murphy, Martin Glaser, Tobias Wilsch, Kit Fine have explored this idea that there's an irreducibly general kind of ground that can be expressed by putting variables flanking the right and left. There is a question, this is better, and I'll drop it. If you want to ask me about it, I can say something in the questions. Okay, but I really think, though, that there's another intuitive problem, which is that bringing the identity relation into the issue just feels like an intrusion of something extraneous that's a sign that something's gone wrong. In any case, let's consider another idea. This is an idea that I think will be more popular amongst gnomic essentialists. So the entry into this idea is through this language of identity. So I started talking about facts about the identity relation holding because I said gnomic essentialists sometimes speak of the identities of properties being tied up with laws. But this language of identity might not be thought to really concern the identity relation. It rather might be thought to concern Kit Fine's idea of essence. A lot of the times when Fine glosses the idea of essence, remember I said that the regimentation is this. Fine speaks of a claim A as being not necessarily true, but holding in virtue of the essences of certain specified objects. So to make a claim like this, you make a statement like, the ancestor relation is a transitive relation. And you might say, that doesn't just happen to be so, and it isn't just barely necessary either. There's something more we can say. It is necessary because of the nature of the relation of being an ancestor. It's essential to the relation of being an ancestor that the ancestor relation is transitive. Fine often glosses claims like these. Instead of saying A holds in virtue of the natures of or the essences of the subscripted objects, he says It holds in virtue of the identities of these things, or it's part of the identity of singleton Socrates to contain Socrates. So maybe this talk of properties, identities being connected with the laws is really a suggestion of a claim of finding an essence. Maybe this is the natural thing to consider, that it holds in virtue of the nature of the property P, where P is any scientific properties, in virtue of the nature of mass, that mass satisfies the laws that it does. So, advantages, this doesn't bring in extraneous stuff about identity. It is intuitively connected with the concerns of gnomic essentialism via connecting principle that Fine accepts between essence and necessity, which is that any essential truth is a necessary truth. So if it holds in virtue of the nature of mass that it play the mass role, the massy role, then it follows that it's necessary that mass plays the mass role, and so role swapping is impossible. So the modal upshot of this is connected with things that gnomic essentialists care about. It also fits with some of the things that gnomic essentialists say. So I've got a quotation from Alexander Bird's book. He says, laws are not, in a kind of gloss on what gnomic essentialism says, he says, laws are not thrust upon properties irrespective, as it were, of what those properties are. Rather, the laws spring from within the properties themselves. I think that's a vivid image, and that is well articulated by Fine's essentialist operator. So, my objection here isn't that this isn't true. It's that it's insufficiently metaphysically revealing. The claim isn't suited to articulate a gnomic essentialist vision of what fundamental reality is like. The claim says, no, actually, before I get into this, it helps to think this thought first. Notice that there's a difference between this claim and the kinds of claims I've been talking about so far, in that the direction of influence is reversed. So the ground theoretic claims I was talking about all had a laws to properties direction of influence, like fact about the laws, grounds, makes it the case that properties instantiated. This is the reverse. It's properties to laws, direction of influence. So it really is quite different from the other. In some sense, this kind of view also might not fit the structuralist gloss that began within the beginning of the talks quite so well. But anyways, I want to flag this fact that there's a properties to laws, direction of influence. The natures of the properties, the natures of the subscript that things are said to give rise to the claim in question. The natures of the properties are such as to make the laws whole. So back to what I was saying. We're told that the properties' natures are such as to make these laws hold, but we aren't told what it is about those natures that makes that the case. We aren't told what it is about the innards of a property, what it is about the property's guts, its nature. We haven't been given a story about that from which we can read off that the laws that it obeys are, in fact, the laws it has to obey. We're just given the bare claim, something about those natures guarantees that this is so. So this is a kind of a concern that should jump at you from the Finean gloss on essentialist locutions. The Finean gloss sounds a bit like there are these things, natures being hypothesized, because the gloss is the natures of X1 and X2 are such as to make A the case, or A holds in virtue of those natures, or A holds in virtue of their identities. And so you imagine there are these things, A's identities, these little containers you can kind of look up and see, oh, yeah, I see, those natures do guarantee that the claim in question holds. But this is that's the gloss, but the expression is logically primitive. The expression has just got subscripts for the things, and then the sentence there follows. So there's no underlying account of what the subscripted objects are like, and there's no commitment to there being such an account when you make such an essentialist claim. that explains why the claim in question holds. That isn't always a problem for claims of finding an essence to be the right answer to the metaphysical question, depending on the context. I mean, sometimes the question that we're interested in, the question we ought to be interested in, the question that's important, might be well answered simply by figuring out which claims are essentially true and figuring out the objects we can pin those claims on. So at least being able to point to objects that are responsible without giving a fuller account of those objects' fundamental natures. But not when you're not in the kind of context we're engaged in here, when we're looking for a vision of fundamental reality that's inspired by these gnomic essentialist slogans. Then we don't want to just say that there's some fact or other about the objects that gives rise to the laws. We want to know what those facts are. This is clearly in the spirit of Jessica Wilson's concern about ground. Remember, Jessica Wilson said, you know, when we're interested in giving an account of the mind, we don't just stop with the generic claim about ground, that the mind is somehow grounded in the body. We say specifically how it's grounded. And I'm saying here, similarly, we're wanting a specific account of the natures of properties. It's unsatisfying in a certain way just to be told that the laws are essential to the properties without being given a fuller account of what properties are. In a way that the grounding claims I started with would have been if they were coherent given the logic of ground. I mean, those were claims about what grounds a property's instantiation. So those were meant to be a claim about the property's guts, so to speak. Without a claim like that, though the essentialist claim feels unsatisfying. The essentialist might well say, look, a more explanatory story may not be possible. Sometimes it is. So there's that example of ancestor I was giving. So, you know, it's true in virtue of the nature of the ancestor relation that the ancestor relation is transitive. That is, ancestors of ancestors or your ancestors of your ancestors or your ancestors. And that's a case in which you can give the kind of plausible story that I'm hankering for in the case of the gnomic essentialist claim. Because what it is to be an ancestor, you might say, what it is for one thing to be an ancestor of another is for the ancestor to be connected to the descendant by a finite series of persons, each of which is a parent of the previous. And so if X is connected by that kind of series to Y, and Y is connected by that kind of series to Z, then X is connected by that kind of series to Z. And so just follows from an account of what the subscripted object is like that the claim holds. So sometimes what they might reply to me, what you want can be had. But it can't always be had, especially if we talk about very basic concepts. So disjunction, for example, maybe it's true. Maybe disjunction obeys the rules that it obeys, like disjunction and reduction, in virtue of its essence. But there's not going to be some further definition of disjunction that we can use to just read off that the rule holds. Or, you know, if you think disjunction is defined in terms of conjunction and negation, then we can repeat the argument for conjunction and negation. There's going to be an end to this kind of story that I want. And so in the end, isn't the essentialist going to have to say that there are some cases of these less informative essentialist claims? And I think, yes, that's true. I'm not saying that it's a terrible thing about essence that's going to have to be stated sometimes. But what I'm saying, though, notice that the concern I had about the essentialist statement is that it doesn't give us a certain kind of picture of the nature of properties. It doesn't give us a certain kind of explanatory account. That complaint is very much like just the postmodalist complaint in general about modal articulations. I'm saying that the essentialist thesis is unsatisfying in the same way that a merely modal articulation of gnomic essentialism would be unsatisfying. Because you aren't, in each case, you're given some facts. You say it's a fact that this property exists, it's instantiated by these things, the property obeys certain laws, and then you're given a kind of add-on from the outside, not coming from the inside of the property. You're given that it's necessarily true that those things hold, or
It's necessarily true in virtue of the nature of one of the things. That's the essentialist version of the modal addition. In each case, it's an addition of something external to the objects in question. And if you didn't find the modal articulation satisfying, I don't think you're going to find this finding an alternative any more satisfying. Okay. So that's what I have to say about that. What I want to say about the generic grounding claim is similar, but I'll continue to not talk about that. So we've talked about attempts to understand what gnomic essentialism is in terms of essence and in terms of ground. What about fundamentality? Let's see if we can find a gnomic essentialist thesis using that metaphysical tool instead. So in terms of fact fundamentality and property fundamentality, it's clear what the opposition thinks. It's clear what the quiditist thinks. The quiditist thinks properties like mass and charge are fundamental properties. Facts about their instantiation in particular cases are fundamental facts. Some quiditists think that laws are fundamental facts too. Others don't. That's a dispute within the quiditist camp. So that's the kind of things that quiditists say. People who think that the properties and laws are independent. But what then in this picture will a gnomic essentialist resist? What's the distinctive gnomic essentialist beef with that picture? Could it be that the gnomic essentialist just thinks that properties like mass and charge aren't fundamental properties? It doesn't feel right. That doesn't fit with what they say. It seems wrong to just downgrade properties like mass and charge to the status of Gruen Bleen. It doesn't fit the gnomic essentialist picture. Also, the gnomic essentialist surely thinks that laws are fundamental, that laws involve properties like mass and charge, and shouldn't a fundamental fact only involve fundamental properties? So I don't think denying that mass and charge are fundamental properties is the right direction. You might think, no, it's instead the bit about the picture that gnomic essentialists don't like is that the particular facts or properties being instantiated, like A's having P, it's that those properties are fundamental facts. And the thought would be, no, those facts aren't fundamental. The only fundamental facts in the vicinity are facts that also have to bring the laws in. Again, back to this idea that you shouldn't be able to understand the properties instantiations without laws being involved. But the only way of making this thought precise, that these facts aren't fundamental, rather the facts always have to drag in the laws, takes us back to terrain we've already covered. The idea that those aren't fundamental, what's really fundamental are existential facts like this. There is some property or other that behaves, it plays the relevant role, and the object has that property. The view that the fundamental, I mean, this really would be a view according to which the fundamental facts involving particular property instantiations always drag in the laws, but it also violates principles in the spirit of the existentials are grounded in their instances. Because, I mean, the analogous principle would be existential facts are never fundamental. Or, more weakly, if an existential fact is fundamental, so are its instances. And this would violate that, because the proposal is that these are fundamental facts. So we're just back to where we were before. But, I mean, let's revisit that now. The argument, as you can see, in two main places, has rested heavily on principles about the logic of ground in one case and fundamentality in the other. So what if somebody rejects one of these principles? What if someone says, sometimes existentials can be grounded in something, don't have to be grounded in their instances. Now, there's one kind of challenge to the existentials are grounded in their instances picture that really isn't relevant here. Some people have kind of funny views about what happens in the grounding relation when you're dealing with non-fundamental subject matters. So take a kind of fictional realism that says that it's Dorothy Gale did really live somewhere in Kansas.
because the stories say that Dorothy Gale lived in Kansas. So it's true that Dorothy Gale lived somewhere in Kansas, but there's no particular place that Dorothy Gale lived in Kansas. So that would be a kind of existential statement that's not grounded in any instance. You might think that that kind of view is true, and you might be open to it, that kind of exception to principles like these. But think, yeah, but that only happens at the non-fundamental level when you're dealing with stuff like truth and fiction. The view here means that at the rock bottom, existentialists don't have to be grounded in their instances. What do we say to somebody who just rejects that? What if that's where the gnomic essentialist digs in? And there's going to be a similar possibility for structuralism about individuals that we'll discuss in 2 weeks' time. Well, I mean, these are hard principles to justify. They certainly seem right. One possibility would be to argue by analogy and say, well, disjunction is closely analogous to existentials. There's a close analogy between saying that something is a certain way and to saying that either this is a certain way or that is a certain way, because to say that something's a certain way is a lot like saying either I'm that way or this is that way or the piano's that way or and so forth. So there's an analogy between disjunction and existential quantification. But disjunctions are grounded in their instances, right? The reason I'm either standing or sitting is I'm standing. My standing grounds the fact that I'm either standing or sitting. And so, since disjunctions are grounded in their disjuncts, the analogous principle, the argument says, should also hold as well. Existentials are grounded in their instances. So, I mean, that might be some progress. That might make some dialectical progress for some people, but others are going to want to know, okay, well, why do you think that disjunctions are grounded in their disjuncts? And, I mean, at some point you're just going to fall back on something you're not arguing for, but let's think a bit about some homes for both of these ideas. What are some natural pictures of the natures of the fundamental facts that would justify both principles? One picture would be, and this is kind of the most extreme and in a way the most satisfying picture, a Tractarian picture, according to which the fundamental facts are all atomic. It's just facts like this is an eraser, or that's an electron, or this is 5 feet from that, or whatever. Those kinds of facts are the fundamental facts, and no logically complex facts are fundamental facts. So there's well-known obstacles to this kind of picture. What grounds negations? If all logically complex facts are grounded in atomic facts, then negations, the fact that this object lacks a certain fundamental property, say, would have to be somehow grounded in all the positive facts about that and other things. And it doesn't seem likely that there are any such facts that would ground negations. Yes, this is a well-known, much-discussed issue. So then there's a weakening of the Tractarian position, which we might call the semi-Tractarian position, which says, okay, it isn't just atomic. Some of the fundamental facts are also negative. Every fundamental fact is either an atomic fact or else the negation of some atomic proposition. So it's negations in atomics that are fundamental. Here, too, there's a standard concern, which is it's hard to see all the atomics and their negations could ground universally quantified facts. So take the fact that everything in the whole world is F. Suppose that everything in the world is in fact F. What makes it the case that everything is F? And the semi-Tractarian is going to have to say something like, well, it's the fact that A is F, and the fact that B is F, and the fact that C is F, and so on, where A, B, and C, and D are all the objects that exist. So the semi-Tractarian is going to say the universal statement is grounded in its instances, all taken together. And, of course, there's a standard objection to that. The objection is, well, look, grounding implies necessitation. So if the instances ground the universal, it has to be that it's necessarily true that if the instances are all true, the universal is true. It's got to be necessarily true that if A is F, and B is F, and C is F, and so on, if all those things are F, then everything is F. And the thought is, that's not true, because it could have been that all the things A, B, C, and D, that was a list of all the things in the world. It could have been that those things are all F, but there existed another thing that doesn't actually exist that isn't F. That could have happened. And if that were true, then the instances, that is the things that are all, in fact, the instances of the universal would all have been true, and the universal would be false. Now, this argument can't be just taken to be correct so quickly now, because Tim Williamson has got this powerful defense of necessitism, which says that it's impossible for an extra thing to have existed. Objects exist necessarily, and necessarily they exist necessarily. So there had been an extra object, would actually exist, and so it wouldn't then have been extra. So, of course, there's a big controversy over whether necessitism is really true. But even if necessitism is true, that does block that argument. But that's not to say it really rescues the semi-tractarian view. That doesn't mean that you really ought to embrace the idea that the instances are in fact the ground of the universe. I mean, intuitively you might think that there isn't a ground theoretic block to an extra thing. There's a modal block. You couldn't have been there. Necessitism is truthfully couldn't have been an extra thing, but that's not relevant to the question of whether the instances ground the universe. I mean, sometimes these modal arguments against grounding claims fail, and yet the grounding claims are obviously false. So if I say all mathematical truths are grounded in facts about my finger, that's a silly view. The finger obviously doesn't make the mathematical truths true, but you can't say, well, it's because that my finger could have existed and the mathematical truths are false, because mathematical truths are necessarily true, and so that's not a possibility. So sometimes we're left on our own devices in evaluating ground theoretic proposals, and this might be one of them. So anyways, there's a live question of whether a semi-tractarian position should be accepted. If it is accepted, that would be a kind of nice home for both the disjunctions and the existentialist principle. Now, resting on necessity, there might be a way, just a further thought here, this is a little bit of an aside, but there may be a further way that's of interest for independent reasons. There may be a further way in which a semi-tractarian might defend the idea that the universal is defended in all their instances. So imagine now that we're not appealing to necessitism here. We're not saying that we're not getting out of that modal argument that the instances don't ground because there could have been an extra thing. We're not blocking that with necessitism. Here's another way, though, a semi-tractarian might respond. Think of an old dispute between David Lewis and David Armstrong over the truth-maker principle. So Armstrong says, you got to believe the truth-maker principle, the principle that if something's true, there has to be an object whose existence makes it true. And Lewis says, I see the itch you're trying to scratch with that truth-maker principle, Armstrong. The itch is something like we want to rule out views which say there are truths that float free of objects, like the view that there are brute counterfactuals. So Lewis says, I share your concern there. But there is a weaker principle, a principle weaker than the truth-maker principle, that can also scratch that same itch. And this weaker principle doesn't have all these horrible consequences of your truth-maker principle, like the existence of states of affairs or the existence of totality facts. And Lewis says, this weaker principle is the principle that truth supervenes on being. Truth supervenes on being scratches the same itch, but it doesn't imply the bad things of the truth-maker principle. Truth supervenes on being is the claim that any two possible worlds that are alike in what objects exist and what their fundamental properties are, their natural properties, Lewis says, are alike in every way. Here's why this is of interest. Really what Lewis is thinking is that an account of fundamental reality, which for him was a specification of things and natural properties, an account of fundamental reality doesn't have to say it is complete by including an Armstrongian totality fact. It just has to be complete. And the supervenience principle is a kind of articulation of this idea that in a fundamental account has to be complete, that doesn't require elements in the fundamental view that say, I am complete. You might think there's something really right about that idea. There's something wrong with demanding of a fundamental account of reality something that says, I am complete. So it's an interesting question of whether there's anything in a ground theoretic framework that might be like that, that the semi-tractarian, the person who thinks that the fundamental facts are negations in atomics, could accept. The problem is on the face of it, this two supervenes on being idea is essentially modal. I mean, the natural way to bring that thought into a fundamentality theoretic context is to say something like this: any two possible worlds that share the same fundamental facts share all the same facts. And that shares the shortcomings of any modal articulation of stuff in this vicinity. So as a way of saying what's fundamental has to be complete, that's no good because it doesn't lay any meaningful constraint down on mathematical truth, for example. So for all that's concerned, one could say, I believe that there are all these mathematical truths, but nevertheless, I don't accept anything at the fundamental level corresponding to them. Because since the mathematical truths are necessary, they satisfy that claim that any two worlds in which with the same mathematical truths have the same fundamental facts. That's trivially true simply because the mathematical truths are all necessary. That's why we want something not superveniency as a statement of the idea that the fundamental has to be complete, but rather something more truth-makery, like every truth has to have a ground that is a fundamental truth, a ground of grounds. That avoids cheap accounts of mathematics, but it gets us back into the problem of needing a ground for universal statements. Well, here's a way that one might be able to kind of finesse this. Suppose the semi-tractarian says something like this. The universal is grounded in its instances, all right. FA, FB. But it's grounded in them qua or as all their instances. The idea is we make sense of just a sui generis different kind of grounding locution, grounding qua, where some grounds are said to ground something qua satisfying a certain condition, or as satisfying a certain condition. This condition is relevant to these being grounds of this, but it's crucial that this be not one of the grounds. The idea is that this would have a distinctive kind of modal implication. When some statements ground qua condition, the modal implication is that it's necessary that if the statements hold and if they satisfy the condition, then the grounded statement hold. And so, even without being a necessitist, one can say, yes, if these are all true, and they're all the instances of this universal generalization, then the generalization would have to hold. The crucial move would be to say that this doesn't have to be part of the ground. And there is a real question about whether this is a legitimate move, because you can't, in general, take what you would normally think of as part of the ground and move it into the condition and say that now it's no longer part of the ground. It would be absurd to say, hey, conjunctions are solely fully grounded in their left conjuncts all the time. Why? Because my standing and speaking is grounded in my standing, qua the fact that I'm speaking. Qua my standing being such that I'm speaking. I mean, if you could just always move a ground into the condition, then that would trivialize the whole search for ground. So the view has got to be that there's something special about totality. There's something we don't want to require. It has to be that you like this Lewis thought that an account of fundamental reality doesn't have to say that it's complete and say that that then can be recognized by demanding only qua grounds of certain sorts, namely where the relevant condition has to do with the totality of the provided grounds. So that's another way that one might try to defend the semi-tractarian position. I don't think that any of this is amounting to a very decisive defense of the existentialist principle. Got about 5 minutes left. Let me skip one thing and make a final comment about nomic essentialism. The thing I'm going to skip was exploring a connection between denying the existentialist principle and denying the disjunctions principle, and thinking of the denial of the disjunctions principle as a way to articulate a kind of defensive metaphysical vagueness. So if you're interested in that, you can ask me about that. So one final thought. We've been looking in vain for a satisfying account of gnomic essentialism in postmodal terms. And I haven't found anything so far that I thought was a suitable articulation in terms of either ground or essence or fundamentality. In many cases, this is because these are hierarchical notions, and the hierarchical demands of these notions conflict with the alleged gnomic essentialist insight. There is, though, one kind of view which doesn't involve any kind of metaphysical funny business at all that actually gives gnomic essentialists a lot of what they want, though I suspect that they won't like this olive branch. So this is a kind of resemblance nominalism. So resemblance nominalism, like it's defended by Gonzalo, for example, is the view which says there are facts about resemblance that are rock bottom. If you have two objects that we would normally say resemble each other because they possess a property in common, so if two electrons resemble each other because they're charged, the resemblance nominalist says, no, that's not why they resemble. The fact of their resembling is what's fundamental. So imagine a resemblance nominalist who takes, for example, kind of primitive plural predicate, the objects, X's, certain objects, all resemble one another, or other predicates of that form, and says the fundamental facts just consist in facts that you can state with this kind of predicate. We're going to want to handle relations as well, so maybe we've got to have some thing about pairs resembling. So the view is going to have to be extended in certain ways, but just stick to the simple monadic case. These things resemble. That's what the fundamental facts look like. Many resemblance nominalisms are forms of Humeanism about laws. That is, they say, there's nothing more to what goes on than just this occurs here and that occurs there. There is no the Humean says laws of nature are really just kinds of summaries of patterns and what happens. And so far, the resemblance nominalism that I've got on the table is a theory like that, because the fundamental facts don't say anything about laws. They just talk about objects standing in resemblances. And that's just a fact about the pattern, not a fact about what must be the case. But you could add some a robust conception of laws into the mix and make things closer, because most gnomic essentialists normally have a more robust conception of laws. So imagine that our basic language, in addition to having this kind of predicate, in addition to having its logical apparatus, and enough logical apparatus needed to make appropriate statements about pairs, imagine it also has a primitive sentence operator. It is a law then. So certain kinds of statements about resemblances could be said to hold of gnomic necessity. So imagine this kind of resemblance nominalism. This view, though distant from the kinds of things resemblance nominalists say, does have one implication that they should like, which is that role swapping is blocked because there simply aren't any properties to permute amongst gnomic roles. All you've got is... I mean, gnomic role is just going to say these things act a certain way and these things act a certain way. There isn't any property that's generating the groups of things. So you've got this resemblance class and that resemblance class. There's no such thing as properties that are generating them to swap. Swapping the properties just keeps the resemblance classes undisturbed. And so there's a very deep block to role swapping. Not only is it impossible to swap roles, a swapping of roles doesn't even correspond to a difference at all at the fundamental level. There simply isn't any way to articulate role swapping. So that's something to end with. Why not that? Okay, let's start.